Blog Talk Radio.
Gandhi said, "Thoreau was a great writer, philosopher, and poet, withal a most practical man. That is, he taught nothing he was not prepared to practice in himself. He went to goal for the sake of his principles and suffering humanity. His essay has therefore been sanctified by suffering. Moreover, it is written for all time. Its incisive logic is unanswerable." Mohandas Gandhi. When in the mid-1950s, the United States Information Service included as a standard book in all their libraries around the world a textbook which reprinted Thoreau's Civil Disobedience, the late Senator Joseph McCarthy succeeded in having that book removed from the shelves, specifically because of the Thoreau essay. Walter Harding in the Variorum Civil Disobedience wrote that. Martin Luther King said, "I became convinced that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. No other person has been more eloquent and passionate in getting his idea across than Henry David Thoreau. As a result of his writing and personal witness, we are the heirs of legacy of creative protest." That was written by Martin Luther King Jr. And let me read the great one. And this is just a quick biography on another quick statement made about him. While Walden can be applied to almost anyone's life, civil disobedience is like a venerated architectural landmark. It is preserved and admired and sometimes visited, but for most of us, there are not many occasions when it can actually be used. Still, although seldom mentioned without reference to Gandhi or King, civil disobedience has more history than many suspect. In the 1940s, it was read by Danish resistance. In the 1950s, it was cherished by those who opposed McCarthyism. In the 1960s, it was influential in the struggle against South African apartheid. In the 1970s, it was discovered by a new generation of anti-war activists. And the lessons learned from all this experience is that Thoreau's ideas really do work, just as he imagined they would. And this is exactly what the people on the ship are doing right now. I believe they believe in this. The Civil Disobedience by Henry Thoreau. David Thoreau. I heartily accept the motto that government is best which governs least, and I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which also I believe, that government is best which governs not at all, and when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Government is at best but an expedient, but most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient. The objections which have been brought against a standing army, and they are many and weighty and deserve to prevail, may also at least be brought against a standing government. The standing army is only an arm of the standing government. The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Witness the present Mexican War, the work of comparatively a few people using the standing government as their tool. In the outset, the people would not have consented to this measure. This American government, what is it but a tradition, though a recent one, endeavoring to transmit itself unprepared to posterity, but each instant losing some of its integrity. It has not the vitality and force of a single living man, or a single man can bend it to his will. It is a sort of wooden gun for the people themselves. But it is not the less necessary for this, for the people must have some complicated machinery or other, and here it's then to satisfy the idea of government which they have. Governments show thus how successfully men can be imposed on, even imposed on themselves, for their own advantage. It is excellent, we must all allow, yet this government never of itself further any enterprise, but by the alacrity with which it got out of its way. It does not keep the country free. It does not settle the West. It does not educate. The character inherent in the American people has done all that has been accomplished, and it would have done somewhat more if the government had not sometimes gotten its way. For government, it is an expedient by which men would fain succeed in letting one another alone. And as has been said, when it's most expedient, the governed are most let alone by it. Trade and commerce, if they were not made of India rubber, would never manage to bounce over the obstacles which legislators are continually putting in their way. And if one were to judge these men wholly by the effects of their actions and not partly by their intentions, then would deserve to be classed and punished with those mischievous persons who put obstructions on the railroads. But to speak practically, and as a citizen, unlike those who call themselves no government men, I ask for not at once no government, but at once a better government. Let every man make known what kind of government would commend his respect, and that will be one step toward obtaining it. After all, the practical reason why, when the power is once in the hands of the people, a majority are permitted and for a long period continue to rule, is not because they are the most likely to be in the right, nor because this seems fairest to the minority, but because they are physically the strongest. But a government in which the majority rule in all cases cannot be based on justice, even as far as men understand it. Can there not be a government in which majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience, in which majorities decide on those questions to which the rule of expediency is applicable? Must the citizens ever for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience, then? I think that we should be men first, and subjects afterwards. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law, so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think right. It is truly enough said that a corporation has no conscience, but a corporation of conscious men is a corporation with a conscience. Law never made men a whit more just, and by means of their respect for it, even the well-disposed are daily made the agents of injustice. A common and natural result of an undue respect for law is that you may see a file of soldiers, colonel, captain, corporal, private, powder monkeys, and all, marching in admirable order over hill and dale to the wars, against their wills, aye, against their common sense and consciences, which makes it very steep marching indeed, and produces a palpitation of the heart. They have no doubt that it is a damnable business in which they are concerned. They are all peaceably inclined. Now, what are they? Men at all? Or small movable forts and magazines at the service of some unscrupulous man in power? Visit the Navy Yard and behold a Marine, such a man as any American government can make, or such as it can make a man with its black arts, a mere shadow and remnants of humanity. A man laid out alive and standing and already, as one may say, buried under arms with funeral accompaniments, though it may be. Not a drum was heard, not a funeral note, as his course to the rampart he hurried. Not a soldier discharged his farewell shot over the grave where our hero we buried. And the mass of men served that state thus, not as men mainly, but as machines with their bodies. They are the standing army, the militia, jailers, constables, posse comitatus, etc. In most cases, there is no free exercise whatever of the judgment of the moral sense, but they put themselves on a level with wood and earth and stones, and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that will serve the purpose as well. Such a command no more respect than men of straw or a lump of dirt. They have the same sort of worth only as horses and dogs, yet such as these men are commonly esteemed good citizens. Others are most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders, serve the state chiefly with their heads, and as they rarely make any moral distinctions, they are as likely to serve the devil, without intending it, as God. A very few, as heroes, patriots, martyrs, reformers, in the same sense, and men, serve the state with their consciences also, and so necessarily resist it for the most part, and they are commonly treated as enemies by it. A wise man will only be useful as a man and will not submit to be clay and stop a hole to keep the wind away, but leave that office to his dust at least. I am too high born to be property, to be a secondary, a control, or a useful serving man and instrument to any sovereign state throughout the world. He who gives himself entirely to his fellow men appears to them useless and selfish, but he who gives himself partially to them is pronounced a benefactor and philanthropist. How does it become a man to behave toward the American government today? I answer that he cannot without disgrace be associated with it. I cannot for an instant recognize that political organization as my government, which is the slave's government also. Now, remember, this was written in 1870 so, or whatever. All men recognize the right of revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. But almost all say that such is not the case now. But such was the case. They think in the revolution of 75. If not, were to tell me that this was a bad government because it taxed certain foreign commodities brought to its ports, it is most probable that I should not make an ado about it, for I can do without them. All machines have their friction. The possibility this does enough good to counterbalance the evil. At any rate, it is the great evil to make a stir about it. But when the friction comes to have its machine and oppression and robbery are organized, I say, let us not have such a machine any longer. In other words, when a sixth of the population of the nation, which was undertaken to be the refuge of liberty, are slaves, and a whole country is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army and subjected to military law, I think that it is too soon for honest men to rebel and revolutionize. What makes this duty the more urgent is the... I think that it is not too soon for honest men to rebel and organize and revolutionize. What makes this duty the more urgent is the fact that the country so overrun is not our own, but ours is the invading army. Paley, a common authority with many on moral questions, in his chapter on the duty of submission to civil government, resolves all civil obligation into expediency, and he proceeds to say that so long as the interest of the whole society requires it, that is, so long as the established government cannot be resisted by or changed into public inconveniency, it is the will of God that the established government be obeyed and no longer. This principle being admitted, the justice of every particular case of resistance is reduced to a computation of the quantity of the danger and grievance on the one side, and of the probability and expense of redressing it on the other. Of this, he says, every man shall judge for himself. But Paley appears never to have contemplated those cases to which the rule of expedience does not apply, in which a people, as well as an individual, must do justice, cost what it may. If I have unjustly wrested a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. This, according to Paley, would be inconvenient. But he that would save his life in such a case shall lose it. This people must cease to hold slaves and to make war on Mexico, though it cost them their existence as a people. In their practice, nations agree with Paley, but does anyone think that Massachusetts does exactly what is right at the present crisis? Thoreau lived in Massachusetts, by the way. A drab of state, a cloth o' silver slut, to have her train borne up and her soul trail in the dirt. Practically speaking, the opponents to a reform in Massachusetts are not 100,000 politicians in the South, but 100,000 merchants and farmers here, who are more interested in commerce and agriculture than they are in humanity, and are not prepared to do justice to the slave and to Mexico, cost what it may. I quarrel not with far-off foes, but with those who, near at home, cooperate with and do the bidding of those far away, and without whom the latter would be harmless. We are accustomed to say that the mass of men are unprepared, but unimproved, but improvement is slow, because the few are not materially wiser or better than the many. It is not so important that many should be as good as you as that there be some absolute goodness somewhere, for that will leaven the whole lump. And there will be thousands. There are thousands who are in opinion opposed to slavery and to war, who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them, who esteemingly themselves children of Washington and Franklin, sit down with their hands in their pockets and say that they know not what to do and do nothing, who even postpone the question of freedom to the question of free trade and quietly read the prices current along with the latest advices from Mexico after dinner, and it may be fall asleep over them. What is the price current of an honest man and patriot today? They hesitate, and they regret. Sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest and with effect. They will wait, well disposed, for others to remedy the evil, and they may no longer have it to regret. It, at most, they give only a cheap vote and a feeble countenance at Godspeed to the right as it goes by them. There are 999 patrons of virtue to one virtuous man, but it is easier to deal with a real possessor of a thing than with a temporary guardian of it. He's so right. To this day, I mean, nothing has changed. There is, for every 999 patrons of virtue, is one virtuous man. All voting is a sort of gaming, like checkers or backgammon and a slight moral tinge to it, a playing with right and wrong and with moral questions, and betting naturally accompanies it. The character of the voter is not stated, the voters is not staked. I cast my vote, perchance, as I think right, but I am not virtually concerned that the right should prevail. I am willing to leave it to the majority. Its obligation, therefore, never exceeds that of expediency. Even voting for the right is doing nothing for it. This it is only expressing to men freely your desire that it should prevail. A wise man will not leave the right to the mercy of chance, nor wish to prevail through the power of the majority. There is but little virtue in the actions of masses of men. When the majority shall at length vote for the abolition of slavery, it will be because they are indifferent to slavery, or because there is but little slavery left to be abolished by their vote. They will then be the only slaves. Only his vote can hasten the abolition of slavery, who asserts his own freedom by his vote. So, you've got to remember, we were facing another moral crisis in this country back when Thoreau wrote this. And this country was still in slavery, and we were in the Mexican War. And, you know, and Thoreau refused to pay taxes. He refused to pay taxes for or vote for anyone, and because of that he was arrested, and was put in jail for the night or so ever. And supposedly his aunt, who was quite embarrassed about the situation, bailed him out, even though he didn't want to be bailed out. He wanted to go to court to contest it, but nevertheless. Family pride got in the way, and they bailed him out. But I want to continue this because he exercised such a conviction here that so few people will do. I hear of a convention to be held in Baltimore or elsewhere for the selection of a candidate for the presidency, made up chiefly of editors and men who are politicians by profession. But I think, what is it to be to any independent, intelligent, and respectable man a decision they may come to? Shall we not have the advantage of his wisdom and honesty, nevertheless? Can we not count upon some independent votes? Are there not many individuals in the country who do not attend conventions? But no. I find that the respectable man, so-called, has immediately drifted from his position and despairs of his country, when his country has no more reason to despair of him. He forthwith adopts one of the candidates, thus selected as the only available one, thus proving that he is himself available for any purposes of the demagogue. And this vote is of no more worth than that of an unprincipled foreigner or hireling native who may have been bought. Oh, for a man who is a man and, as a neighbor says, has a backbone or has a bone in his back which you cannot pass your hand through. Our statistics are at fault. The population has been turned too large, has returned too large. How many men are there to a square 1,000 miles in this country? Hardly one. Does not America offer any inducements for men to settle here? The American has dwindled into an odd fellow, one who may be known by the development of his organs of gregariousness and a manifest lack of intellect and cheerful self-reliance, whose first and chief concern on coming into the world is to see the almshouses are in good repair, and before yet he has lawfully donned the viral garb to collect the fund for the support of the widows and the orphans that may be, who in short ventures to live only at the aid of the mutual insurance company, which has promised to bury him decently. It is not a man's duty, as a matter of course, to devote himself to the eradication of any. Even the most enormous wrong, he may still properly have other concerns to enrage him. But it is his duty, at least, to wash his hands of it. And if he gives it not thought longer, not give it practically his support. If I devote myself to other pursuits and contemplations, I must first see at least that I do not pursue them sitting upon another man's shoulders. I must get off him first, that he may pursue his contemplations too. See what a gross inconsistency is tolerated. I have heard some of my townsmen say, I should like to have them order me out to get put down an insurrection of the slaves, or to march to Mexico. See if I would go. And yet, these men, these very men, have each directly by their allegiance, and so indirectly at least by their money, furnished a substitute. The soldier is applauded who refuses to serve in an unjust war by those who do not refuse to sustain the unjust government which makes the war, is applauded by those whose own act and authority he disregards and sets at naught, as if the state were penitent to that degree, that it hired one to scourge it while it sinned, but not to that degree that it left off sinning for a moment. Thus, under the name of order and civil government, we are all made at last to pay homage to the support of our own meanness. And after the first blush of sin comes its indifference, and from immoral it becomes, as it were, unmoral, and not quite unnecessary to that life which we have made. The broadest and most prevalent errors requires the most disinterested virtue to sustain it. The slight reproach to which the virtue of patriotism is commonly liable, the noble are more likely to incur. Those who, while they disapprove of the character and measures of a government, yield to it their allegiance and support are undoubtedly its most conscientious supporters, and so frequently the most serious obstacles to reform. Some are petitioning the state to dissolve the Union, to disregard the requisitions of the President. Why do they not dissolve it themselves, the Union between themselves and the state, and refuse to pay their quota into their treasury? Do not they stand in the same relation to the state that the state does to the Union, and have not the same reasons prevented the state from resisting the Union which have prevented them from resisting the state? Sure. So, yeah, I mean, in this day and age, I mean, why should we, why do states talk a big game, but yet allow their citizens to continue to support the war with their income taxes, all right? Not state income taxes, but federal income taxes, all right? And why? Why is this? They're just dogs smelling another dog's butt, a bigger dog's butt, basically. They just don't care. Right? Municipal government and state government, okay, are all got their hands out for federal dollars, okay? And those federal dollars are based upon our income taxes, which is essentially an unconstitutional, tax, okay, an unlawful tax, believe it or not. But, like those who protested, and those who legally protested, paying their taxes, find themselves in front of an IRS, or find themselves in front of the Supreme Court, or Superior Court, and finding themselves serving 10 years or so to in jail for not paying his illegal taxes. So there's the rub of our system. You know, just a joke. joke. How can a man be satisfied to entertain an opinion merely and enjoy it? Is there any enjoyment in it if his opinion is that he is aggrieved? If you are cheated out of a single dollar by your neighbor, you do not rest satisfied with knowing that you are cheated, or with saying that you are cheated, or even with petitioning him to pay you your due. But you take effectual steps at once to obtain the full amount and see that you are never cheated again. Action for act for principle. The perception and the performance of right changes things and relations. It is essentially revolutionary and does not consist wholly with anything which was. It not only divides states and churches, it divides families. It divides the individual, separating the diabolical in him from the divine. Unjust laws exist, shall exist. Unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded, or shall we transgress them at once? Men generally, under such a government as this, think that they ought to wait until they have persuaded the majority to alter them. They think that if they should resist, the remedy would be worse than the evil. But it is the fault of the government itself that the remedy is worse than the evil. It makes it worse. Why is it not more apt to anticipate and provide for reform? Why does it not cherish its wise minority? Why does it cry and resist before it is heard? Why does it not encourage its citizens to be on the alert, to point out its faults and do better than it would have them? Why does it always crucify Christ and excommunicate Copernicus and Luther and pronounce that Washington and Franklin rebels? One would think that a deliberate and practical denial of its authority was the only offense ever contemplated by government. Else, why was it not assigned its definite, its suitable, and proportionate penalty? If a man who has no property refuses but wants to earn 9 shillings for the state, he is but in prison for a period unlimited by any law that I know, and determined only by the discretion of those who placed him here or there. But if he should steal 99 shillings from the state, he is soon permitted to go at large again. It's fascinating, isn't it? How we become slaves. We become slaves. We're better to stand firm, all right, and on an issue, and go to jail because you'll get out, all right, as opposed to being indebted or held hostage or extorted for the rest of your life, okay, because of your own cowardice. If the justice is part of the necessary friction of a machine of government, let it go, and perchance it will wear smooth. Certainly, the machine will wear out. If the injustice is a spring or a pulley or a rope or a crank exclusively for itself, then perhaps you may consider whether the remedy will not be worse than the evil. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another man or another, then I say break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. What I have to do is to see, at any rate, that I do not lend myself to the wrong which I condemn. As for adopting the ways which the state has provided for remedying the evil, I know not of such ways. They make too much time, or they take too much time, and a man's life will be gone. I have other affairs to attend to. I came into the world not chiefly to make this good a place to live in, but to live in it, but be it good or bad. A man has not everything to do. But sometimes, and because he cannot do everything, it is not necessary that he should do something wrong. It is not my business to be petitioning the governor or the legislature any more than it is theirs to petition me. And if they should not hear my petition, what should I do then? But in this case, the state has provided no way. Its very constitution is the evil. This may seem to be harsh and stubborn and unconciliatory, but it is to treat with the most utmost kindness and consideration the only spirit that it can appreciate or deserves it. So in any change for the better, like birth and death, will convulse the body. I do not hesitate to say that those who call themselves abolitionists should at once effectively withdraw their support, both in person and property, from the government of Massachusetts, and not wait till they constitute a majority of one before they suffer the right to prevail through them. I think that it is enough if they have God on their side without waiting for the other one, for that other one. And moreover, any man right than his neighbors constitutes a majority of one already. Any man more right than his neighbors constitutes a majority of one already. I meet this American government or its representative, the state government, directly and face to face once a year, no more in the person of its tax gatherer. This is the only mode in which a man situated as I am necessarily meets it. And it then says distinctly, recognize me, and simplest. This is so long, I know it, but if a plant cannot live according to its nature, it dies, and so a man. The night in prison was novel and interesting enough. The prisoners in their shirt sleeves were enjoying a chat and evening air in the doorway when I entered. But the jailer said, come boys, it's time to lock up. And so they dispersed, and I heard the sound of their steps returning to the hollow apartments. My roommate was introduced to me as the first-rate fellow and a clever man. When the door was locked, he showed me where to hang my hat and how he managed matters there. The rooms were whitewashed once a month, and this one, at least, was the whitest, most simply furnished, and probably the neatest apartment in the town. He naturally wanted to know where I came from and what brought me here, there. And when I had told him, I asked him in turn, how he came there, presuming him to be an honest man, of course, and as the rule goes, I believe he was. Why, said he, they accused me of burning a barn, but I never did it. As near as I could discover, he had probably gone to bed in a barn when drunk and smoked his pipe there, and so a barn was burned. He had the reputation of being a clever man, had been there some 3 months waiting for his trial to come, and would have to wait as much longer, but he was quite domesticated and contented, since he got his board for nothing, and thought that he was well treated. He occupied one window and I the other, and I saw that if one stayed there long, his principal business would be to look out the window. And I soon reached all the tracks that were left there, and examined where former prisoners had broken out, and where a gate had been sawed off, and heard the history of the various occupants of that room. For I found that even here, there was a history and a gossip that never circulated beyond the walls of the jail. Probably this is the only house in the town where verses are composed, which are afterwards printed in a circular form but not published. I was shown quite a long list of verses, which are composed by some young men who had been detected in an attempt to escape, who avenged themselves by singing them. I pumped my fellow prisoners as dry as I could for fear I could never see them again. But at length he showed me which was my bed and left me to blow out the lamp. I was like traveling into a far country, such as I had never expected to behold, to lie there for one moment, one night. It seemed to me that I never had heard the town clock strike before, nor the evening sounds of the village, for we slept with the windows open, which were inside the grating. It was to see my native village in the light of the Middle Ages, and our Concord was turned into a Rhine stream, and visions of knights and castles passed before me. They were the voices of old burghers, and I heard in the street. I was an involuntary spectator and auditor of whatever was done and said in the kitchen of the adjacent village inn. A wholly new and rare experience for me. It was a closer view of my native town. I was fairly inside of it. I never had seen its institutions before. This is one of its particular institutions, for it is a shire town. I began to comprehend what its inhabitants were all about. In the morning, our breakfasts were put through the hole in the door in small oblong square tin pans made to fit and hold a pint of chocolate and brown bread and an iron spoon. When they called for the vessels again, I was green enough to return what bread I had left, but my comrade seized it and said that I should lay that up for lunch or dinner. Soon after, he was let out to work at haying in a neighboring field, whither he went every day, and would not be back till noon. So he bade me good day, saying that he doubted if he should see me again. When I came out of prison, for someone interfered and paid the tax, I did not perceive that great changes had taken place on the common, such as he observed, who went in a youth and emerged a tottering and gray-haired man. And yet a change had, to my eyes, come over the scene, the town, the state, the country, greater than any that mere time could effect. I saw yet more distinctly the state in which I lived. I saw to what extent the people among whom I lived could be trusted as good neighbors and friends, and their friendships was for summer weather only, that they did not greatly propose to do right, that they were a distinct race from me by their prejudices and superstitions, as the Chinamen and Malays are. That is, that in their sacrifices to humanity, they ran no risks, not even to their property, that after all, they were not so noble, but they treated the thief as he had treated them, and hoped, by a certain outward observance and a few prayers, and by walking in a particular straight through useless path from time to time, to save their souls. This may be to judge my neighbors harshly, for I believe that many of them are not aware that they have such an institution as a jail in their village. It was formerly the custom in our village. This goes on a little. I really love it, but I wanted to get to. I didn't realize it. I didn't think it would take so long. But it's longer than I remembered. I'm going to ask you if you'd like to read this, and I really highly, highly recommend that you do. Please go to the Thoreau Reader. Okay. That's Thoreau Reader, and I've got all of his essays here. And just put in, if you're searching, just put in civil disobedience, right? The essays, and you'll see it right there. He wrote this in 1849. Following your own conscience. Life without principle, he wrote in 1854. Thoreau railed against a culture whose primary focus is financial. He also wrote against slavery in Massachusetts. 1854, Thoreau attacked the support of slavery in his home state. Plea for Captain John Brown. Brown tried to ignite a slave rebellion. Thoreau responded in 1859. Succession of forest trees. Convince me that you have a seed. I'm prepared to expect wonders. I don't know what that was, but, yeah. In 1862, described wellness as a treasure to be preserved rather than plundering. His essay, Walking. So, I'm going to refer you to Henry David Thoreau there, and the Thoreau Reader. And while I do that, I'm going to go to... some updates here on the Gaza the road to Gaza. Attila update. First article I just received it today, and I was quite excited because I had a picture of my friend Gail on it, and some of the crew members. Just quite exciting. And it's, I wanted to read this. It's a short article, and it's out, put out by the Plus 972, I believe, is the group. And this is Plus Sign 972, right? Independent reporting and commentary from Israel and the Palestinian territories. Flotilla, this is today, flotilla organizers Greece complicit with Israel in delaying departure. At a press conference held at 3 p.m. local time on Thursday, which is today, but I believe we're a day beyond, day ahead of them, or a day behind them. Organizers of the U.S. boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope, unveiled their ship to International Press Corps. Roughly 70 journalists, including a news crew from Israel, Channel 10, as well as other Israeli journalists, were in attendance. Organizers defiantly called on the government of Greece to allow their boat safe deployment and passage. Former U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright, speaking on behalf of the U.S. ship, demanded that the Greek government follow through with inspection of the ship, following an Israeli illegal organization's accusation that it is not seaworthy. Wright insisted it is seaworthy and that the Greek government is complicit with the Israeli government in delaying and trying to stop our boat from sailing. During the press conference, all 35 passengers of the Audacity of Hope stood in front of the ship draped in American flags. Wright specifically called on the Greek government to protect the U.S. boat from acts of state terrorism, referencing the alleged sabotage of the Irish boat. According to Wright, the Irish boat has 20,000 euros worth of damage and would have sunk if it left port. And that happened because of the sabotaging. Okay? Sons of bitches. That was the, Israeli government. Pulitzer Prize winner author Alice Walker, a passenger on the boat, on the U.S. boat, read letters out loud at the press conference. The boat is carrying over 3,000 personal letters from Americans to Gazans. One letter had a huge illustration of a smile and said, "Smile, the world loves you." And Walker compared the situation in Israel to that of South Africa during apartheid, saying that our ancestors would be upset if they knew we were standing by in silence and not in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Organizers spread out the thousands of letters on the lower deck of the boat for the press to see. And before the press conference, the boat organizers invited press into the boat, which was which was opened and exposed to disprove any allegation there was dangerous cargo on it. And the Israeli news crew took a tour of the boat, filming every crevice. So that's the update on that. And you can check that one out at Plus 72 is the there's another. There was something else I wanted to bring up tonight, and I don't really have the time to do it, fortunately. But I think I might be able to find more information on it in a second here. I'm sorry, I was just kind of looking. Looking through some of these posts, but I wanted to let me go to a website here that might have it. Let's see if there's any more news and views from the Gaza flotilla. They usually send updates every day. I just want to make sure that I got them. I should mention, too, that this is something else that's very important. This time, I'm not really sure, I guess in England, hundreds of thousands of public sector workers strike. Pensions, protests, well... pensions protests well-supported claim unions as workers join picket lines outside schools and public buildings while the government insists more people are turning up for work than expected. Let's see. The leader of one of the four unions involved in a national strike has said that the government will be proved wrong in its prediction that few will walk out and protest on the overhaul of public sector pensions. And, yeah, this is, people are getting pissed off, you know, and I don't blame them. You're starting to, you know, they're starting to pick at everybody's pensions now. They're starting to, you know, what they promised and what they, you know, were promised ain't happening. So, you know, it's a rotten damn thing, I tell you. This is Greece, part of the riot. And, this is...
Alba.
I just cannot believe, I cannot believe the brutality of these goddamn cops. Check out the police brutality here. Totally unbelievable. In Greece, they got some serious shit going on. A riot in Athens is a war zone. Right? Greece riots, violent video of project, unbelievable. 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 Somebody made a song here. I just saw a flotilla song. plays it. We still have 4 minutes for me to get to play. I don't know what it is, but... Gaza Flotilla Song. Find it. Said it was there, but I can't find it. Let's see this one. This is the Flotilla song.
Have you heard of the ship called the Mavi Marmara? With her crew of thugs and terrorists, she sailed from old Gaza. And on YouTube you can watch them all in all their reveries, in clubs with wild abandon at Jews out on the sea. Now Gaza, it is ruled by a genocidal crew. They'd rather give their sons to mama than to believe in truth. So sailing up the coast, spoke of Gaza's awful plight, but she had a chance with Kaibar. Made it clear they'd fight that night. Tell me, where do you stand? Tell me, what do you say? As the winds of war from Gaza's shore blow through our doors today, raise your voice and not back down, or will you turn away? Tell me, where do you stand? Tell me, what do you say? Israelis tried to talk the crew into docking at Ashdod. From there, they take their food by truck to Gaza down the road. The other ships agreed, and they docked there peacefully. Mavi moves ahead, bent on hiding his treachery. Israelis came onto the ship with no weapons in their hands. One by one they came aboard, but they did not understand how human beings could descend to such depravity. But we know because we watched it all. Tell me, where do you stand? Tell me, what do you say? As the wind of war from Gaza's shore blows through our doors today, will you raise your voice and not back down, or will you turn away? Tell me, where do you stand? Tell me, what do you say?
Check this thing out at the YouTube, Treachery at Sea, the Flotilla song. Very, very fascinating. Good song, too. Surprised it only got a few, it just got up there and it's got 30 songs, got 30 views. So, anyway, folks, that's the show tonight. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you learned something. And please support the people on this ship to Gaza. They really, really need your help. They need your support. And I want to thank everybody. And I wish you a very cool night. Let's see, what am I going to end with here? On with a, not sure. What to do? Maybe I'll end with, not sure. I got some neat songs here I want to end the show with tonight, but, okay, where are they? Where? The link that go? Let's try this one. Good night, everyone.